Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Whether thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no home, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul, whatever thou be, until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles. I'm Dan.
Hello, Dan. I'm Lindsay.
Hello.
Hello.
And Lindsay Liu has two quick announcements, and then we're into the stories.
Okay, great. Well, my first announcement is just a quick reminder that when you hear this episode, which is probably on the 24th of April, today is your last day to submit your application for the Commons Family Scholarship. You can go to badmagicproductions.com, look for the banner. Applications are due today, April 24th at 3 p.m. Central Time. Look at your phone, figure out your time zones. I know time zones are like, they're a real struggle, okay?
And what's the date again? 3 p.m. Central
April
Time?
April 24th.
April 24th.
So,
all right.
This comes out at midnight on the 23rd. So, eek.
Get it in there.
Let's go. And then our charity announcement this month, on April 23rd, day that this comes out, we celebrate World Book Day. And Dan,
love books.
Yeah. As lovers of knowledge and escapism, books are some of our most favorite things to spend our time and money on. And in honor of World Book Day, this month's donation will be going to First Book, a nonprofit working to inspire young minds through books. They believe that books are a critical resource for kids, but they can be scarce for those that are in disadvantaged neighborhoods and communities. And in fact, First Book discovered book deserts in which like low-income communities often have just one book per 830 kids.
Wow.
Which is an astonishing number. It was very upsetting for me. Even growing up without a lot, books were in abundance around me. So anyways, if books are something that matter to you in any way, shape, or form, you can learn more by visiting firstbook.org. And we are sending them $12,950. Thank you, Roberts and Annabelles, for your financial support and allowing us to be able to do these kinds of donations. It's so fun.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And now, how much horror, Lindsay? That's what the creeps and peepers really want to know. How much horror?
How many horror stories do I have? I have two. My first story is a more traditional haunted house, a family-owned home and multiple sightings, and a very interesting detail at the end that I was like, oh, you little stinker. And then my second story, I don't know if we have ever had a fan-submitted exorcism. I could not think of one. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist
maybe years before. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So a very interesting story that will take us to Canada. It's wild. Cool.
And interesting.
Yes, nailed it. I'm really pumped for that story. It's a nice, long, juicy tale.
Okay. You'll never guess how many supposedly true horror stories I have.
Hold on. Hmm? Two.
Oh my God, you did guess it.
I'm psychic.
That's crazy. My first story is much more likely to be familiar with true crime fans than with paranormal horror fans. It's the story of the disappearance of the Grimes sisters.
Nope.
A massive manhunt was carried out in Chicago in late December of 1956 when two sisters, 15-year-old Barbara and 12-year-old Patricia, went out to see a movie and never came home.
Oh, damn.
What makes this story suitable to be told here are a bunch of witnesses seeing these girls after they vanished in places they just could not be. And I won't give away more than that, because if I do, I'll ruin it. My second story takes us to Anderson, Carolina, where a ghost may have been caught on camera at the Anderson Municipal Business Center in 2009. I'll share details of what was supposedly seen and heard, plus an anonymous encounter story, and I have some interesting video that I'll show you.
Okay.
Which I thought was super cool.
Yeah, rare that we have video.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very rare. And very rare to me that I'm like, oh, that is hard to explain.
And can I just ask one question before you dive into your tales? You said Anderson, Carolina?
Uh-huh.
North Carolina?
Oh, Anderson. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh my gosh, South Carolina. Okay. I didn't put the...
I mean, it doesn't matter, but I was just curious because I was like, wait a second. Did I miss something?
Once you feel securely socked, all cozied up and protected, I'll get started.
Okay, I'm still not lifting my foot up for the sock. I start PT in 2 weeks, so hopefully then. I have a little, who said cousin It? I have a little It chapter
little
two. Yeah, The Lost Boys. So we saw a great horror movie last night.
Yeah, Late Night with the Devil is as good as advertised.
Yeah, very different, really beautifully shot, very cinematic.
Yeah, heavily stylized and just, yeah, very unique. And man, and there's this... Lily, the girl who plays Lily, she is going to be doing a lot of movies, I feel like. She came out of nowhere and just killed it.
Really talented actress. And I mean, the man, the myth, the legend, Stephen King said he couldn't take his eyes off of it. And I would agree.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. This first story, a little bit of setup here before we really get into it. Okay, just making sure I had a little thing written in here.
Okay, sure.
It was December 28th, 1956. That sleepy, quiet time between Christmas and New Year's where nobody quite knows how to fill their days, at least if you don't have to go to work. It's the yearly chance to be lazy around the house, to marinate in holiday leftovers, catch up on books, and just in general, take it easy. But for Barbara Jeanine Grimes, or Barbara Jean Grimes, all of this downtime for rest and relaxation was getting old. She was bored out of her mind. The 15-year-old desperately wanted to get out of the house. She lived with her mother, Loretta, who worked as a clerk for the Park Davis Company, a pharmaceutical manufacturer. She'd been divorced for about 11 years from Barbara's father, who had remarried, leaving Loretta to raise Barbara and her six siblings alone.
Woo!
Of all her siblings, Barbara had one she was closest to, her 12-year-old sister, Patricia Kathleen Grimes. They were inseparable. Both attentive students at the Thomas Kelly High School and St. Maurice's Catholic School, respectively. And with both girls wanting to get out of the house, they hatched a plan. They decided to go to the Brighton Theater on Archer Avenue for a showing of the newly released Elvis Presley movie, Love Me Tender. Mm-hmm. Despite being newly released, both girls had already seen the movie 11 times.
Oh my gosh.
They were Elvis fanatics. And they thought that seeing him on the big screen again would be the perfect thing to spice up an otherwise dull night. They were already thinking about how they would write about the experience to the Elvis Presley fan club that they just joined.
So cute.
So at about 7:30 p.m. on the night of December 28th, 1956, the girls left their home with $2.50 between them, plenty back then to get two tickets and add a couple of concessions if they wanted them.
Hot damn, take me back.
Barbara kept 50 cents of the money in a zippered pouch in her wallet in case they also wanted to see the second screening of Love Me Tender that night. They promised their mother, Loretta, that they'd be home before midnight. It was just a mile and a half to the theater. They'd either walked or taken the bus there hundreds of times. They'd made it to the theater on time. This was confirmed by a school friend of Patricia's named Dorothy Weinert, who would later say that she'd been seated directly behind the girls with her own sister. Dorothy would leave at the intermission at 9:30 p.m., and as she left, she saw the Grimes sisters lining up to get some popcorn. They decided to go to that second movie after all. Loretta, back at home, could have predicted that her daughters would have been seen the second show. They were Elvis fanatics, but that meant they still should have been home no later than 11:45. But they weren't. They were still out there, trying to come home. The only question is, while they were out there trying to come home, were they alive or already dead? Time now for the tale of the ghosts of missing girls. When they weren't home by midnight, Loretta was worried. She'd sent their older sister, 17-year-old Teresa, and 14-year-old brother Joey to go wait for the girls at the bus stop closest to their house. There they did wait. They waited, and they waited, and they waited. A bus soon pulled up and unloaded its passengers, but no girls. Then a second bus pulled up, unloaded its passengers, and still no girls. By the time the third bus came, they didn't expect the girls to be on it. And they were right. Loretta, meanwhile, was busy calling all the girls' friends in a desperate bid to see if they decided to have an impromptu sleepover. When nothing turned up, she filed a missing persons report, which the Chicago Police Department entered into their files at 2:15 a.m., December 29th. In the end, the disappearance of the Grimes sisters would become one of the largest missing persons cases in the history of Cook County, Illinois. A citywide search for the girls was quickly initiated, to which hundreds of police officers were subsequently assigned full-time. Cook County officers were assisted by colleagues from surrounding suburbs, and a task force devoted solely to locating the sisters was formed, with the ground search initiated on December 29th, bolstered by hundreds, if not thousands, of local volunteers. And to their relief, they started to get reports of sightings. Reports poured in that the girls had been seen after leaving the movie theater. They'd been glimpsed on the street from a bus window, seen in different parts of the city by different people at different times. Numerous people stated to investigators that they had seen the girls boarding a Chicago Transit Authority bus on Archer Avenue, heading east into the city after the screening. Those who reported this sighting to police included the bus driver. The sisters allegedly got off the bus at Western Avenue, approximately halfway between the theater and their home, at roughly 11:05 p.m. Their mother found this strange. Why would they leave the screening with nearly a half hour to go when they were such big Elvis fans? A young man named Roger Menard informed investigators he had also attended the December 28th screening of Love Me Tender, having sat behind Barbara and Patricia Grimes and very close to their friend Dorothy Weinert as well. According to Menard, he had left the theater approximately 1 minute before the sisters, who he soon noticed were walking down Archer Avenue a short distance behind him, and that a, quote, late model green Buick had stopped alongside them. The girls looked at the car and hesitated before continuing walking. Just past 42nd Street, with the sisters by this stage walking ahead of him, a black 1949 Mercury, occupied by two teenage boys, pulled alongside the girls, who he now saw simply giggle before continuing walking in the direction of their home. Then two other teenage boys, Ed Lorden and Earl Zastro, informed investigators that while they had been driving through McKinley Park at approximately 11:30 p.m. on December 28th, they had seen the sisters on 35th Street. Reportedly, the two had been giggling and jumping out of doorways at each other near Seeley and Damon Avenues, with one youth exclaiming to the other that they were those two Grimes sisters as they passed. At this point, the girls, if these boys were telling the truth, would have only been approximately two blocks from their home, even though the bus driver for CTA said that he had driven them nearly into the city by this time. Then a security guard named Jack Franklin later informed investigators he had offered directions to two girls on the morning of December 29th, approximately 12 hours after they had left the theater. What was going on? That same day, a friend of the girls would report seeing Barbara and Patricia at approximately 2:30 p.m. walking westward on Archer Avenue. And a classmate of Patricia's named Catherine Borak was adamant she had seen Patricia walking past a restaurant. Borak had been inside in the early evening of December 29th. At this point, Barbara, a good rule-following girl, would have been gone for a full day. According to Borak, Patricia had been in the company of two unidentified young girls. This sighting was followed by another 6 hours later, by a cashier at the Clark Theater in downtown Chicago who claimed she had seen both girls at 12:45 a.m. There was just one thing off about all of these tales. The missing persons investigation had already started in earnest. If the girls were walking around the city, how come the police didn't so much as glimpse them? Also, these reports, though from different places, people, and times, all mention the same thing. The two girls did not look happy to be out on their own. They looked sad, almost haunted, and they were always outside looking in, as though waiting to be invited inside. The police didn't know what to make of these reports. Maybe these people were just experiencing a bad case of wishful thinking. False reports in these situations are sadly far from uncommon. Perhaps these witnesses were confusing other girls for the Grimes sisters. Or perhaps they were still out there, and there was hope of finding them alive. Police doubled down on their efforts, going door to door with canvassing, posting flyers, coordinating with parishioners of the sisters' church, offering a $1,000 reward for any information leading to their whereabouts. They questioned over 300,000 people, with over 2,000 people subjected to serious interrogations. Two would confess to kidnapping the girls, but both quickly recanted, saying the police had coerced them. Police coercion, sadly, all too common back then. Everyone was desperate to find these girls. Police hoped that they were either runaways or staying with boyfriends, both things people who knew them said were highly unlikely. They also feared the worst and ended up dredging multiple canals and rivers in search of remains. Still, there was nothing. Well, almost nothing. Sighting reports did keep trickling in, one after the other, day by day. The sisters were seen outside businesses, outside homes, always with the same haunted look on their faces, as though pleading for someone to help them. On January 1st, 1957, the girls were reported as having been seen aboard a Chicago Transit Authority bus on Damon Avenue. On January 3rd, three different employees at the Inglewood Credge department store all claimed to have both seen the girls listening to music at the store's record counter. Each employee, questioned individually, stated that the two sisters had been listening to music by Elvis Presley. The following week, a night clerk at the Unity Hotel on West 61st Street refused two girls a room because of their age. The clerk believed these girls had been the Grimes sisters. As the weeks passed, an idea that the girls would have run off seemed less and less likely. The police even advocated the theory that they had run off for one very special person, Elvis Presley himself. He'd played a show in Nashville a few days after the girls had gone missing, and the Graceland estate would even make its own statement weeks after the girls disappeared. If you are good Presley fans, you'll go home and ease your mother's worries. Elvis Presley himself got on the radio and personally pleaded for the girls to return home. Adding credence to the theory that both sisters had run away to Nashville, on January 17th, a woman named Pearl Neville contacted investigators to state that she had met both girls in a Nashville restroom on January 9th, and that she had accompanied them to a state employment agency to search for work. According to Neville, both girls had been in what she described as a tired, bedraggled condition. A clerk at this agency would later identify the sisters from photographs, also recalling that the girls used the surname Grimes in the application forms that they had filled out. But why, if they were in Nashville, were they still being reported as being witnessed in Chicago? One person would have a strange conviction about what had happened. On January 15th, a 53-year-old steam fitter, someone who installs and maintains industrial pipes, named Walter Kranz, reported to a Chicago Police Department switchboard operator that he'd had a psychic vision that both girls had already been murdered and that their bodies would be found in an unincorporated area of Lyons Township. Franz refused to disclose his name to the operator in this phone call, simply stating that he'd experienced this revelation in a dream before terminating the call. Nevertheless, the operator was able to trace the call to a location close to his home. Investigators hoped that this was just some attention-seeking crackpot, but on January 22nd, they would learn that was maybe not the case. Following a rapid thaw of recent snowfall, a construction worker named Leonard Prescott spotted what he later described as being these flesh-colored things behind a guardrail as he drove along a rural county road named German Church Road, approximately 200 east of County Line Road in Willow Springs. The road was within a mile of the location described by Walter Kranz in his call. Glimpsing the figures from the road, Leonard Prescott thought initially they were mannequins, and he and his wife Marie pulled over. Who would dump mannequins out here in the wilderness? As they got closer, Marie whimpered and then actually fainted. They were the nude, frozen bodies of the Grimes sisters. The Prescotts immediately reported their findings to the Willow Springs Police Department, who found that the girls' bodies lay upon a flat, horizontal section of snow-covered ground directly behind the guardrail, which extended for just 10 feet before the incline of the embankment of Devil's Creek. Barbara lay on her left side with her legs drawn slightly up towards her torso. Patricia lay on her back with her body covering her sister's head and her own head turned sharply to the right. It was clear that both had been driven there in a car, had their bodies dragged or lifted out of the vehicle and thrown over the guardrail. Three wounds resembling those typically inflicted by ice picks were discovered upon Barbara's chest, and injuries resembling blunt force trauma were visible upon her face and head, while numerous bruises were discovered upon Patricia's face and body. There were no obvious fatal wounds, though. In the end, their deaths were recorded as homicides, and that they had died due to a combination of shock and exposure. Their bodies were strangely clean, and none of their clothing was found near the scene. Barbara seemed to have engaged in sexual intercourse before her death, unclear if it was consensual or not. But the most perplexing find was yet to come. Forensic pathologists found that due to the contents of the girls' stomachs, they had most likely died within 5 hours of the time they had last been seen alive at the Brighton Theater. So how had so many people seen them wandering around Chicago? Not just a few sightings, but dozens. In the end, the chief investigator of the Cook County Coroner's Office, Harry Gloss, strongly believed an official suspect in the case named Edward Bedwell had committed the sisters' murders. Edward was a 21-year-old semi-literate drifter who had been a dishwasher in a Chicago Skid Row restaurant, and he bore a very strong resemblance to Elvis Presley. Bedwell would even confess, saying he had hung out with the Grimes sisters until January 7th, drinking in various West Madison Street Skid Row saloons before he and a companion fed them hot dogs, beat them to death, and discarded them in a ditch. Upon reading Bedwell's confession, the girl's mother, Loretta Grimes, was quoted as saying, "It's a lie. My girls wouldn't be on West Madison Street. They didn't even know where it was." And the coroner's report found that neither girl had hot dogs in their stomachs. Indeed, they had popcorn from the movie theater, meaning they had not lived long past the time they left the movie theater. Bedwell had also clocked into work around the most likely time of the girl's abduction, working overnight on December 28th in a suburb of Chicago called Cicero. And yet, Harry Gloss insisted. Was Chief Inspector Gloss saying that he suspected Bedwell because he wanted to vehemently deny that so many people were seeing ghostly apparitions of the girls long after they had died? Did he just want to pin it on someone? Gloss was ultimately fired in the middle of February of 1957 by Coroner Walter, adding yet another wrinkle to this strange case. Bedwell would recant his confession, saying he had again been coerced by police, and he was never charged. And there hasn't ever been a credible suspect since, nor any explanation of why so many people saw the Grimes sisters when they were supposedly dead. The case would be unofficially reopened in 2013 when a retired West Chicago police officer named Raymond Johnson began a personal investigation into the case. He believed the true perpetrator was a 23-year-old confessed child killer named Charles Leroy Melquist, who had been considered a suspect back in 1957 and then would be convicted of the September 1958 murder of a 15-year-old girl named Bonnie Leigh Scott. Unfortunately, he had died in 2010. Maybe in the future, some piece of evidence will show up to conclusively solve the case, to identify the real killer, what happened, and how long the girls lived. There are still some people alive who were alive back then, someone who could have seen something. But even if the murders are conclusively solved, it's unlikely we'll ever get an answer to the mysterious apparitions that seem to have plagued Chicago, and also Nashville, in the winter of 1956 and 1957. Could they all have been misidentifications, wishful thinking, or all part of some kind of mass terror-induced hallucination? Possibly, sure. But if even one of those apparitions was real, if even one of them was some imprint of the Grimes sisters left at a moment of ultimate terror, what possibilities does that open up? Were they still alive when those apparitions appeared, and somehow these apparitions appeared to draw viewers in, to call them in to help, or were they already dead? Were these apparitions the last wisps of their beings, one last fleeting plea for justice to somehow escape the harm that had already been done to them? Either way, we hope the Grimes sisters are now resting in peace, and maybe somewhere out there in the great beyond, they finally got to meet Elvis.
Damn, that's so creepy.
Mm-hmm.
On so many levels. I mean, there's the true crime level.
Yeah.
Then there's like the parental level. Like, my heart is just breaking for this mom.
Yeah.
I mean, this family, it's just awful. But what I couldn't like get past was like, Okay, our kids go to a movie. I mean, like, now it's 2024 and we have Find My. But like, listen, like, killers and rapists and murderers and kidnappers, they're aware of technology. So like, okay, They toss our kids' phone aside. The last known moment is here. And we can't find them. And then people start telling us that they're seeing our children. Uh-huh. I would go insane because I would stop everything I was doing and go to that place and interview everyone and be hounding the police there. And now they're over here. And now they're over there. I mean, I cannot imagine the anguish of constantly feeling like you were just one step behind where they were. And I understand the, you know, when they found the bodies and, you know, estimating time of death and all of that. But I still think that in my brain, I would be thinking like, I don't know. Do I trust that? Is that for sure it? Like, what if I could have gotten to Nashville sooner? Yeah. Would I have saved my children? I mean, it is so upsetting on so many levels. And then on the paranormal side, like, what?
I know. I'd never thought of that
with
false confessions before, like having a ghost involved. Because we've covered this a lot on Time Suck. And sadly, not only is there a lot of false witness statements when somebody goes missing, like when there's a big search for somebody, there's also a lot of weird false confessions. I never thought that was a big thing. But like, whenever there's a big manhunt for somebody, it is crazy how many people will not only claim to have seen the person in a place they couldn't have been once they find out where the body is, but then the police will get people who just come in and say like, yeah, I did it, and clearly did not do it. They don't know anything about the case. It's like a weird attention seeking kind of behavior, but I'm like, God, I never thought that would be a thing.
I want to ask you a question, and I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, and then we can move on to the photos. But has that increased, that false confession syndrome, let's call it, has that increased the more that social media and the 24-hour news cycle has increased?
I don't know.
Because if it is attention-seeking, which most obviously it is, you know, I mean, there's going to be elements of different kinds of mental illness playing a part in it, but just like people are so freaking obsessed with being famous. Which I know might sound comical coming from two podcasters, but like we don't want to be famous. We're not famous. That is not a desire for us. We just love telling stories.
Yeah, it's a nice side effect. For me, I look at it as a practical thing where it's like, if we're known more, that means more people are enjoying the stories, which gives me more job security.
Right.
As opposed to like, look at me.
Yeah. I don't want to. And I also don't want to be like, you know, like I've run into fans, obviously places, but like I love
that. It's nice.
It is wonderful. And I love those beautiful moments, but I can't imagine being like, you know, Brad Pitt and needing security all the time. And like, I love going to the market. I just want to go to store.
Yeah,
so
that
anyways,
level's insane.
So, but the more that social media promotes, like everyone has a voice, everyone should be famous, everyone, it's like, yikes. And so then when you have high profile cases, it already is going to attract a certain
I bet it has kicked up, especially false witness things. That's different to me than a false confession, where it's like people want to like, they want to be an important part of the story, you know, feel important, and then maybe get interviewed on the news. So they do get like fame, their 5 minutes of fame that way, or 15 minutes or whatever. And then, but that like, that false confession thing, I think like, okay, like what if you do that and then they do charge you? And it's like, is the fame worth it? Where you're like, you're sitting in a prison cell and you're like, ah, man, I'm in the paper. You have like a little stack of newspapers in your cell. Be like, check this out, guys.
But then also,
page two. Pretty cool, huh?
Once you're locked up, you're like, ah, shit. And now you can't get out of it because they're like, well, you confessed.
That would be a good thing to ask people who have done that. And then how to see how many like fan letters or correspondences they get.
Oh my God.
Like, well, now I have like a fan base or like people to talk to.
I mean, yeah, there are some weirdos who seem to thrive in prison and like on the notoriety. Yeah. They have people write to them. They have a certain level of clout in prison where they're like they did the nastiest crime or whatever. We've come across a lot of those dirtbags.
Sure.
I only have one picture. This is just the last picture taken of the girls before they went missing, used to put on flyers. That's Barbara to the right and younger sister Patricia to the left.
Oh my God. They just look so wholesome and sweet and happy.
Yep.
Like clearly at some dinner, some wedding or something.
Yeah, crazy.
Now, is this the one with the video or is it the second story that has video?
No, the second story has very interesting video.
As you were talking, I decided in my mind that you had video. So I was like, oh my God, are we going to see like CCTV of these girls in places?
Too far back in the 50s. Yeah.
Listen, I was excited. Okay. I mean, that's just so crazy. I also made a note like, because you said something about people were seeing them in places and it seemed like they were trying to get in places, but being waited to be invited in. You used a very specific phrase.
Yeah,
and I was like,
Did
they become Black Eyed Children? Like, I mean, horrible. They're dead. But like, because we don't know how Black Eyed Children come to be.
I don't
know their origin. So I was like, holy shit.
No, more like probably like long ears. I don't know. Just
I
like
know,
the,
I yeah, know, but yeah. I wanted a reason.
Yeah.
I wanted to make them Black Eyed Children.
Are you ready to leave this sad tale for something less tragic?
Ah, yeah. That one was heavy.
Before we move on to more scares, we need to take a quick in-between story sponsor break. What is the most basic gift you have ever given the moms in your life for Mother's Day? Flowers? A candle? Some random knickknack you picked up at the last minute because you completely spaced Mother's Day?
I have definitely made the mistake of procrastinating gifts for Mother's Day, and then, like the Friday before, I run to whatever store is open and convince myself that, yes, my mom does need another coffee mug that declares she's the world's best. So lame.
This year, how about one upping yourself by giving the moms in your life an Aura picture frame? Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to any mom at any age. Aura frames connect easily to Wi-Fi and have unlimited storage so you can share as many pictures as you want.
This year, as many of you know, I am on a spending freeze, but one of my carve-outs was meaningful gifts for the people I love. I don't want to give all of the moms in our lives something that won't bring them joy. We are giving Aura frames to the moms in our world because they are timeless, heartwarming gifts.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code SCARED at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
Thanks for listening to our sponsor deals, Creeps and Peepers. And now it's time to look into a South Carolina haunting. I'll briefly go over the claim of the entity caught on camera and then jump into an encounter claim. And then at the end, yeah, we will have that video.
Okay.
The Anderson Municipal Business Center, located in the small 30,000-ish person upstate city of Anderson, South Carolina, went viral in 2009 for reports of a haunting. The building was fairly new at the time, but the land the building sat on was once part of a large estate called Echo Hall, which belonged to a prominent judge and former mayor, J.P. Reed. In June of 2009, security cameras inside a credit union in the corner of the building captured what some interpret to be a ghost. It is interesting, I will say that. At the very least, I'll share footage at the end of the story again. Workers have also claimed that they have heard things like doors slamming on their own. Local news crew and paranormal investigators visited the office, conducted tests with the flashlight and car headlights to see if an earthly source could be discovered to have caused the sighting of some supposed apparition, like a light flicker on camera or something. They were not able to provide a satisfactory explanation, not able to recreate anything even close to what we're going to see. And one of the paranormal team's recorders picked up the distinct sound of footsteps long after everyone had left for the evening. In addition to this, there have been a few reports from staff of a shadowy human figure materializing and then disappearing throughout the office.
No, thank you.
The following story comes from one former staff member who had a pretty brief but very terrifying encounter with this shadowy entity. Time now for the tale of Terror in the Stairwell. It had been one of the most exhausting work days I had ever experienced. I'd gotten to work early, around 6:30 a.m., and had been working nonstop all day. It was tax season, which meant I had a mountain of paperwork on my desk that seemed to be growing each day. Normally, I liked my job because it was straightforward and I could take my mind off of work as soon as I left the office. But at this time of year, I had to stay late to prepare reports. I didn't like being in the building late at night. It gave me the creeps, it always did, starting with the very first day I was in it. This day, like most days, I was alone in my office, which was hardly bigger than a closet. I had both the overhead light and my desk lamp on, but I still couldn't stop thinking about how I was surrounded by such a massive dark building. We did have security guards, which I was thankful for, but it didn't make me any less nervous. The sun had fully set by 8 o'clock. My manager had left an hour earlier, had urged me to go home too, but I wanted to stay. No, I needed to stay. I just had so much work to get done. I hoped that if I made one big last push, I'd be able to finish by 5 p.m. the next day, which was Friday, and then I would get to go home and actually enjoy my weekend. I should have just worked that weekend. My decision to stay that night would turn out to be a regrettable one. When I finally finished, I turned off my computer and rubbed my tired eyes, leaning back in my chair. My sigh of relief abruptly cut off when I heard footsteps outside my door. Who was out there? I thought I was the only one in the building. Or at least in my section of the building. Security always sat in their office and watched the monitors. They rarely did walkthroughs unless there was an issue to check out. I started to panic. But then relief flooded through me when a perfectly reasonable explanation entered my mind. The custodians. It must be the custodians. I knew they came in at 7 and had been told they didn't normally make it to our section of the office until around 9. It was a little after 9, so it would make sense that they were near now. Relaxing a bit, I packed up all my things and made sure I would be able to I would be ready to walk to my car as quickly as I could. Despite feeling like I'd solved the mystery of what I'd heard, I was still a little apprehensive walking through the dark building. Like I said before, the building at night always gave me the creeps. Slowly, I opened the office door and peeked out into the dark hallway. And now I felt scared again. I really didn't want to, but in order to get home, I had to walk through a darkened section of the building. Gathering my courage, I turned off my office light, shut the door, briefly plunging myself into what felt like total darkness. My heart leapt into my throat, and I immediately began power walking. And soon, I'd activated the motion sensor, the light above me illuminating a little section of the hallway. I twisted around, looked at the darkened hallway behind me, and it felt like something was back there. I turned back around, walked as fast as I could, practically jogging my way to the stairs. No way I was going to wait on an elevator for two flights. Not with how I felt. The short hallway felt torturously long, and as I walked, I swore I started to hear footsteps behind me. My head whipped around, but I saw nothing. Definitely no custodians. And now the footsteps had stopped. I was shaking with fear by this point, and now I started running. I was just about 10 steps away from the door leading to the stairs when I heard it again, footsteps. Soft footsteps dampened by the carpet approaching from behind me. And I looked back again, and again I saw nothing but the half-illuminated hallway, the light casting an eerie glow on the empty office. Fortunately, I'd made it. I pushed open the door to the stairwell, waiting for the motion-activated light to turn on inside, but it didn't. Then I remembered that earlier that day, someone had mentioned it was out. The custodial staff apparently had not replaced the bulb yet. Where were they? I still hadn't seen a trace of them. Well, I still needed to get out of the building. With the moonlight from a small overhead window guiding my way, I walked down the stairs with one hand on the railing. I needed to be extra careful because my phone was dead, and the last thing I needed was to fall and break my leg and have to wait for someone to find me. I had just finished making it halfway down when I froze on a landing, fear chilling me to the bone. The door above me clicked and softly swung open, like someone was trying not to get caught sneaking into the stairwell. I wasn't crazy. Someone was following me. A second later, I heard the sound of someone walking towards me. Swallowing nervously, I turned my head and gasped at what I saw. The noise stopped, and now I witnessed the shadow of a man darker than the already dark stairwell. It was nothing more than an outline, an image, but I felt an air of menace. For a moment, it felt like we were having a standoff. What I was seeing didn't make any sense, but now I was sure that this thing had been following me. It had been waiting for me outside my office. I was afraid to move, but knew I had to do something.
Go, get out!
In my panic, I dropped the folders I was carrying, keeping only my purse and my car key in my hand, and ran as fast as I could the rest of the way down the stairs. I heard that shadow, that evil thing chasing after me, its pounding footsteps now close behind. I heard no voice, no heavy breathing, felt no hands reach out to grab me, but still it chased me. Thankfully, soon the end was in sight. I reached the door to what led to the main lobby, where the security were. I pushed open the door with all my strength, the momentum sending me flying out into the lobby. I dared to look behind me and saw nothing, heard nothing. The chase was over. I'd won. But I could still feel the shadow's presence. As odd as it sounds, I knew it was just behind the door to the stairs, and if I went back to get my papers, something bad would happen. A vision of me falling down the stairs, no, being pushed down the stairs, entered my mind, and then, hey, are you okay? I about jumped out of my skin. I didn't even see the security guard standing no more than 10 feet away. Yes, I lied. Sorry, I just got a little scared of the dark, I guess. Oh, he said, putting together what he thought was going on in his mind. The light, right? Got the call this morning. I guess they forgot. I'll make sure they'll replace it in the morning. I'll have them do it now, or I would have them do it now, but I think John called in sick, and he was the only guy scheduled to come in tonight. So there's no custodian here tonight? No. Why, you hear or see something? No, I lied. There was no point in getting into it. Also, the longer we talked, the longer it would have taken me to get out of the building and just get home. Have a good night, I said nervously. And then I took off before he possibly decided to walk into the stairwell, where he would see my files and want to talk to me some more. I wasted no time speed walking to my car and locking myself in. I tried to think about what happened on my way home, but the terror was too fresh. I thought about all the people who had jokingly mentioned that the building was haunted. Maybe it wasn't a joke. What happened that day was thankfully my only encounter with that shadowy entity. I have no idea what it was, and honestly, I don't want to know. I just hope I never see it again. If I do, it will not be in the stairwell, because I have taken the elevator ever since.
Damn. That's terrifying.
Uh-huh. A stairwell would be a nasty spot to be chased.
Oh, yeah. It's so easy to fall and get hurt, just like in your... Listen, I can barely walk up and down stairs without, you know, kind of stumbling a little bit. I always need a railing. Like, I am just an accident-prone kind of, you know, klutzy human. So racing down the stairs. No bueno.
And I'd be afraid that sometimes this happens in like hotels. Usually, I mean, obviously there's a bottom exit where you can get out.
Oh, but sometimes you can't.
Uh-huh. But I'd be afraid like you're racing down, you hear something chasing you and then that door at the bottom is locked.
That's why you have to like suddenly decide to like run out into like mid, you know, second floor. Don't wait till the last one.
Yeah, but then if you're just running into a different part of a dark building, that could be scary
too. I don't know, but maybe you're running into a lobby full of people.
I have two pictures and then this video.
Oh boy. Okay.
So the first picture, I just thought these pictures were funny. This is not the type of building you would expect to be haunted. It's not that old. It's just this municipal business center. It's built by the city government.
Right. It's just like a very plain stucco.
Yep, just a government building.
Yeah, like just stucco, beige,
uh-huh.
Blah.
Part of the building is the police department. Here, this next photo.
It looks like the Department of Caffeinated Beverages.
Oh, yeah, a little bit. It's just like, okay.
That looks like a hotel. That looks like a Red Roof Inn or something. You know,
right,
just like
right.
A really simple,
very
basic,
simple building.
Clean, but nothing special.
Okay, now here is that video, just on loop.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So it's two little sections. You'll see an arrow.
Okay.
Look at that chair.
Okay.
Look at that thing that seems to walk over and sit in the chair.
Holy shit. Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh my God. Okay, where in the building is this?
There's a credit union in like a little corner of the building.
Okay, I would say it looks like a little lobby with like a... Okay, uh-huh. So what we're looking at, for those of you who can't stop and go to our socials to see this video, what we're looking at looks like a very small, like... You know, when you walk into a doctor's office, it has a very tiny waiting room and there's like the glass partition, and behind the partition is the secretary, whomever's checking you in. And then there's one chair and it's like a very benign, like basic waiting room chair. And there's a plant in this room. It's a very small,
like a bedroom size, a very small lobby.
You cannot misconstrue this. There is not a window to the outside. There is a window next to the door that is that sort of like frosted glass so that you can see into a hallway, but there's just no way. This is like someone is coming out from behind the secretary's area and walking to go sit in this chair, except you don't see a person, you just see an apparition.
Blur.
Oh my Jesus.
Some people have tried to say that maybe there was a bug on the security
lens. That's a giant ass bug.
And it's like weird that it'd be translucent and happen to move straight across right into the chair.
I feel like would be more erratic.
Yeah.
Think about the way a fly flops around.
Uh-huh.
Oh my.
I mean, I don't know.
Sweet baby Jay. Oh,
yeah.
I don't like that.
It was just, I included it because I mean, most of the time when I come across stories that have like, hey, and there was a picture taken, there was this video.
Yeah, usually it's like, eh.
Yeah, it's like really grainy or the video is so bad. I'm like, I don't know. That doesn't look like anything. That's not worth even showing.
Right.
But this one, I was like, maybe.
Yeah, usually they're very mid, as our daughter would say.
Yeah.
But this is not.
This is not
Woof.
Mid. Yeah.
That is so creepy. That is so creepy.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that story, I absolutely terrified myself because there's this camera that points at me. And I got distracted because I was like, what is going on? Well, you know, it is reflecting this image, which is pentagram.
Oh, yeah.
Or pentagram-esque. And all I could see in the camera, I was like, oh, my God, there's a pentagram in the camera. I'm being haunted right now. No, absolutely not. That is so creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And what a tough choice, elevator or stairs? Because if you're waiting for the elevator, you are a sitting duck. It really is somebody coming for you.
Uh-huh.
And then elevator doors notoriously close very slowly. So now you could be waiting for the elevator, get in the elevator, and still be stuck with a person or an entity.
Yeah.
I understand the choice of the staircase because it's like, it's sort of like being in bumper-to-bumper traffic, where it's like, even if you get off and take side roads and there's also traffic, at least you're moving.
Yeah.
But when you're in that like standstill position, it makes you feel so trapped and crazy.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, I'm going to take the stairwell in an attempt to just get out of here.
Yep.
You could also be trapped in the stairwell with something, but at least you're moving.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Ay-ay-ay.
Ichi-wawa. Ichi-ichi-wawa. That was... Oh, no. I do not like that. I wonder what happened when she went back to work the next day.
I don't know. Yeah, probably. Well, I guess if it was light out, probably she was fine.
But did you talk to other people? Have they had that same experience? Like, I would be trying to corroborate what happened to me.
Yeah. I mean, it said, like, in the beginning that there's been multiple reports of different, like, staff saying that they've seen some dark shadowy entity in the same building. There was a whole like this local news station in Anderson.
Yeah.
They did a whole like, I want to say like 6 to 8 minute video.
Yeah.
Where they sent in some, reporters talking to like some of the staff, paranormal investigator. They set up a bunch of stuff. And
I love it. Yeah, I love they invested in it.
They did a whole little expose on this municipal building. And their kind of angle that they thought was funny was like, this just is not the kind of place that ever comes up on like a movie, a haunted.
Right.
You know, like anyone's vision in their mind of like, ooh, that's a haunted house is not going to match that place.
Yeah.
It's not old. It's not like Victorian. It's not like there's not a bunch of weird shadowy places. It's just a very bland building.
Yeah. Very benign.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a Layla over there?
Oh, no. I had grabbed. Oh, wait. I grabbed one.
What did you
do
with
bring
her?
In here?
Well, that's okay.
I had a red one, but then I lost her.
You could squeeze me.
Okay.
Oh, you know what? Behind you is Crochella.
Boom.
Boom. There's always Layla's on hand. Fear not. Fear not. I do love that one. That might be my most favorite, Layla. Mm-hmm. It's just so dang cute.
It is.
So cute. Okay, well, as I mentioned before, my first story is a somewhat traditional haunted house.
Okay.
Hey, Dan and Lindsay. My name's Jeffrey, and do I have a story for you? My story begins with my parents getting divorced and my father moving in with my stepmother, Jen. We got along pretty well from the beginning and bonded over our love for all things left field and odd. One of those things was the supernatural. As a result, we regularly discussed the haunting of her Aunt Myrna's properties that she experienced growing up. And just by the way, like Aunt Myrna, that is like the perfect owner of a haunted home. Myrna owned two homes, the yellow house that they lived in and the white house that served as a home for Myrna's grown children, but that she refused to enter that home alone. On a beautiful sunny day in Canton, Mississippi, Jen and I visited her aunt, who was not hesitant to sit us down and serve us lunch. Following our meal, Myrna and Jen chatted while I explored the home and gazed at the antique decor. I turned to take the first step on the carpeted stairs when I suddenly felt a freezing blast of air pass through me, followed by the fragrant scent of rose-smelling perfume. A skeptic by nature, I immediately checked if there was a logical explanation as to what I had just experienced. In a split second, I noticed that all of the windows and doors were closed, and since both properties were built pre-Civil War and had been updated very little since, AC was only available in two rooms. My eyes were drawn to the landing where an older woman in a white nightgown stared at me warmly with kind eyes. As soon as I fixed my gaze on her, she was gone. Feeling terrified would make logical sense, yet I have never felt more at peace and loved in all my days. Walking back into the living room with a smile on my face, Aunt Myrna, without missing a beat, looked at me and said, "Lucy must like you." I asked her how she knew. "Lucy prefers little boys over girls. That's why your sister and cousin were scared of her." And sure enough, I asked my stepsister and cousin about someone named Lucy at our aunt's home, and they both said that they saw an older woman dressed for bed that appeared, grimaced at them, and then vanished on two different dates, years apart. On a random day just this last January, and years after the encounter with Lucy, we visited the White House to collect some of Aunt Myrna's belongings after she had passed away. Her son, Glenn, let my family, my boyfriend, and I through the front door, and everyone passed through just fine, except for me. The moment I passed the threshold, my entire body sunk as I became dizzy and promptly fainted. I was out for some time, but when I awoke with a wet cloth on my forehead, my family had told me it was probably just the heat, which made it only more odd. Canton had faced a cold winter that year, yet the interior temperature of the house was as though the setting were in a sauna, despite the thermostat being set at 60 degrees. I removed layers of winter coats and sweaters, just as my family did, and we got to work. I helped my family for hours, with nothing strange happening but the unbearable heat persisting. This was around until Glenn had called me upstairs to help with some items he'd found. I made my way up the steps and entered Glenn's bedroom, where the heat was so unbearable it became difficult to breathe. He handed me some things and we headed downstairs with the items. But as we were making our way down, we were simultaneously stopped, dead in our tracks, by what we saw. On the floral wallpaper was a face of a humanoid creature that seemed to be mid-scream. Nowhere else in the home can this pattern be found in the rather boring green wallpaper. We called my dad, Jen, and then boyfriend to verify that we were not crazy. They told us they too could see it, and my dad even snapped a picture of it. However, that picture my dad captured on his iPhone grew darker and darker by the hour, and by the end of the day, it was only a black screen. As the day progressed, we realized that this project was going to take multiple days and decided to spend the night at the home. Little did I know, this would be the night from hell. As my sister, boyfriend, and I said goodnight to everyone and got ready for bed, I couldn't shake the feeling that something was off, as the heat had only intensified as the night grew darker. All that aside, my boyfriend and I were tired. We tucked ourselves into bed and quickly fell asleep. It seemed like it had only been a second after falling asleep when we both awoke at 3 a.m. to find both of our bedside lamps on and the faucet in the ensuite bath gushing water. I got up to turn the water off, and as my boyfriend turned his lamp off, he looked at me strangely. I made my way back to bed. As his eyes met mine, the bed began to vibrate. This vibration turned into a rattle, and the rattle turned into a violent shake that could be felt throughout the entire room. My boyfriend was yelling, "Jeffrey, what the fuck is going on?" It was as though he was being pushed down into the bed as it shook completely off the floor. Being the naive teenager I was, I sprinted to my sister's room for help. I opened the door, but walked no further when I saw that their beds are also shaking violently. Both of my teenage sisters were crying and unable to take their eyes off the ceiling. I met where their eyes were fixed, yet saw nothing but the antique chandelier that had always been there. And just like that, the shaking stopped. The silence that followed did not last long, however. Not a second later, the chandelier fell from the ceiling, shattering on the floor. I ran from their room back to where I had been sleeping. It was on the run that I felt a painful and blunt sensation in the back of my head as though someone had hit me. As I returned, my boyfriend gasped, "Oh my God, you're bleeding badly." I felt the warm liquid streaming down my back and noticed that I had bled halfway down the hall. I woke up my parents and told them I needed a ride to the hospital, that I had fallen in the shower. I was driven to the nearest ER, promptly stitched up and kept for observation. I could not have been happier to be out of that house. We agreed not to tell our parents the truth, as they would never have believed us. We did tell Glenn for fear of his safety, but he just shrugged it off and said we were making it up. A few weeks went by when we saw Glenn at our family's New Year's party. It was there that he told us he had a confession to make. He told us in detail about dabbling in black magic, and even more lucidly, he described a ritual he had performed to summon a demon named Alistair to target the neighborhood punks who had defaced Aunt Myrna, his mother's, tombstone. Since then, none of us have been back to the house, and I don't plan on returning in this lifetime.
Aye, aye. One of the creepiest one detail, I mean, the blood is... But
something like truly attacking you.
Uh-huh. Is terrifying. But the face in the wallpaper.
I know. Oh my God.
That apparently goes away because they took a picture of it and then the picture got blacker, but you know, darker. But it's like,
yes.
I'm guessing, even though it wasn't explicitly stated, that it faded from the wall too. Otherwise, they would have maybe tried to take more pictures of it from different cameras.
That's what I took away as well.
But man, I just think about like, I'm just thinking about like our house and mm-hmm. like some wallpaper and like uh-huh. you know, you're looking at this pattern.
Oh.
And then, you know, like obviously the pattern repeats the nature of wallpaper.
Right.
And then all of a sudden there's this one spot where you're like, wait a minute, what's that?
Uh-huh.
And you can't find it anywhere. And it looks like a face, which is they say frozen in mid-scream.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about, there's this incredible bookstore in Post Falls that we love called Kindred and Company. Uh-huh. And the downstairs restroom has this wallpaper that looks like a cornfield, if uh-huh. I'm remembering correctly. But then in the corn stalks are faces or like maybe even skulls. It's creepy.
And there's snakes.
Yeah. It's like creepy if you stare at it long enough. And that's what I was envisioning. Like, oh my God, mm-hmm. you're just staring at this repetitive pattern when something appears. I don't know what I would do.
God, I wonder if that's been done in a horror movie, because that gives me the chills thinking about it. But you're just looking at like this wallpaper, and then all of a sudden, like you're just seeing a little creature,
like
showing up and moving around in the wallpaper.
Do you remember those? I know you didn't grow up going to the mall like regularly, right? Yeah. Just like as like a teenager in the city, that was what we would do. Like on a Friday night, we'd just go to the mall, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And for a long time in the Palmertown Mall. There were these kiosks and they sold those pieces of art, and it was like,
oh yeah, how you let your eyes unfocus and you're supposed to see a pattern.
It looked like pointillism or something. Uh-huh. You know, you would just stare at it for long enough and then something would appear.
Do you see the ship?
Yeah. And if sometimes I could and sometimes I couldn't.
I know, I hated those. I was always the friend who never could see anything.
Oh, poor baby.
Yeah.
But imagine this horror movie. You're in the mall, Friday night with your friends, like a throwback film in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And you're staring at it and they can all see good. It. And you, but what you see, you're the only one who can
see.
They
all see a ship. You see a demon face.
Uh-huh. And then that face starts showing up in like every piece of like, let's pretend your parents are art collectors or your mom works as a museum curator and sometimes brings her work home with her. And now every framed piece of art, it's there. Like, ugh.
Yeah, yeah.
That could be, there's some nightmare fuel for you. Oh, but yeah, so creepy. And then like at the end, that confirmation of like, Glenn, you mofo doing your black magic.
Uh-huh.
Come on.
Yeah, that demonology stuff.
Yep, yep. Yeah. And also just like telling the kids that like, oh, you made that up, knowing full well they did not.
Right, right.
Well, shit.
Good. That was a good story.
Yeah, I really like that one. A different kind of haunted house. I just love Aunt Myrna. Like if I have an Aunt Myrna, she definitely lives in a haunted house. Uh-huh, I just can't get past that. Okay, now my next story is an exorcism tale. Mm-hmm. And it is lengthy, so settle in. It is well-written, intense in moments, and like just kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
A Cuban exorcism in Canada. Greetings to the king and queen of the creeptastic and peeperific. I've been on the fence about sharing the story, but a recent episode you shared encouraged me to do so. Hold on to your fucking hats. My brother-in-law, sister-in-law, and their two kids lived in a house for about a year before I arrived on the scene. My first time in their house, my spooky spidey sense creepy crawled up my spine and I thought, well, there is something in this house. But it didn't feel horrible. Some examples of this weirdness quickly. My husband and sister-in-law were talking in the dining room next to the dining room table when suddenly one of the chairs moved out quickly. My husband, thinking it was his niece or nephew, pulled up the tablecloth, looked underneath saying, who's there? There was no one there. And at that exact moment, all of the kids and I came running into the room. Another time, my nephew was sitting at the kitchen table eating breakfast and said to my sister-in-law while looking down the hallway towards their bedrooms, who's that man? To which she replied, who's who? And my nephew replied chillingly, the man that just walked from your bedroom into mine. They happened to be the only two people that were home at the time. This was unnerving, but it was what was happening to my three-year-old niece that really upset everyone. She would point to a dark corner in her room and say, there's the X-ray man. Now, can we all just take a pause and think about children's alphabet books? The letter X is often depicted as a person behind an X-ray, showing their bones. So basically, a skeleton. At first, everyone just laughed it off. But as she got older and moved into a big kid's bed, she would wake up in the middle of the night screaming bloody murder. Either her mom or dad would have to sleep with her in her bed. Each parent felt that even though she had fallen back to sleep, they should not leave her as they also felt something in the room. Now, my husband has a business associate who has worked around the world, including Cuba. And there he met the love of his life, an African-Cuban woman who worked for the Cuban government. They secretly married because she worked for the Cuban government. She was not allowed to marry a foreigner and began a life that was split between Cuba and Canada. She practiced a religion known as Yoruba, which is a spiritual practice that originated in Nigeria. This practice was brought over to Cuba by African slaves during the 1800s. It is similar to the more commonly known Santeria, but has many differences. During one of their stays in Canada, a Cuban associate accompanied them who was also a Yoruba priest. This was Carlos's first time out of Cuba, and he was enjoying Canada. He was a kind-hearted, unassuming man that puts one at ease the moment you meet him. However, Carlos spoke very little English, so our business associate and his wife translated for him. Eventually, we found out what Carlos did in Cuba and asked about his many experiences. Carlos was not only an Olorisha, a Yoruba priest, but was also a medium and a world-renowned healer. He had many people seeking him out to cleanse their spirits, deal with their ghosts, and so on. When my brother-in-law told him about some of the odd stuff that was happening at their house, Carlos invited himself over for brunch the next Sunday. Sunday arrived, and everyone feasted on the usual brunch fare. It seemed like a normal brunch, with Carlos describing his life in Cuba and how much he was enjoying being in Canada, although he was always cold. After brunch, the kids went downstairs, and the adults began to talk. Carlos told my brother-in-law and sister-in-law that there were indeed spirits in the house and that the worst of them was someone called the Horseman. He said that the spirit was not fixed to their house, but rather to the area. Carlos believed that, while alive, the man rode a horse and was not kind to young girls, and that my niece was his target and they needed to protect her. He also said that the horseman was trying to cause problems in their marriage by making one of them get up in the middle of the night to sleep with their daughter, thereby leaving the marital bed. On a side note, 5 out of 8 couples that lived in their cul-de-sac had either been divorced or were in the process of getting one. Carlos implied that the horseman had caused these divorces. He said he could get rid of the horseman if they wanted him to, and of course they agreed because their baby girl was being threatened. He gave them a list of things he would need to obtain for the ceremony, which would take place over 3 days, beginning on Tuesday. The first ceremony would occur around noon, the second in the afternoon, and the third in the evening. Some of the objects required for the ceremony were a stuffed toy horse, gunpowder, white plates, a large piece of wood, a bouquet of flowers, cooked rice, sugar, black, white, and red materials, coconuts, incense, salt and pepper, white candles, an empty bottle of wine, rum, a large stick, a ribbon, and a live chicken. On Tuesday, I went to their house. Carlos arrived with his translators and quietly began to make preparations. He took a special chalk he had brought with him from Cuba and began writing symbols on the piece of wood. He put cooked rice, salt, and pepper in 4 bowls and put the bowls throughout the corners of the house. He instructed us to light incense, go outside, and stick 1 piece of incense in each of the outer corners of the house. Carlos began reciting Yoruba prayers. From what I understood, the wood with the symbols was for an altar. The bowls of rice were offerings to the good spirits, and the incense was to protect the home. He split open the stuffed toy horse, pulled out the stuffing, and put an herb packet inside. This was an effigy of the horseman. Carlos then took 1 bouquet of flowers, the wood with the symbols, and built an altar outside to honor the protector spirits of the home. He called all of us outside and put a white chalk cross on all of our foreheads and began chanting in Yoruba while hitting the ground rhythmically with a large stick. At this point, Carlos realized that he'd forgotten something sweet and a bowl of rice as an offering to the protector spirits, so I went inside to grab this from the kitchen. I grabbed the items and began walking outside, passing the hallway that led to the bedrooms. At the end of the hall, out of the corner of my eye, I saw something standing with his arms crossed his chest and had a feeling emanating out of him of pure anger. I realized I had just seen the horseman, and he was angry. I returned outside and did not say anything. I did not want to interrupt Carlos. I gave him the bowl of rice and the sweets, and he began chanting again, sometimes slow and quietly, sometimes fast and loudly. I'll never forget the sounds of Carlos's chants. He then took a painter's bucket of water and the other bouquet of flowers, breaking the flowers off and putting them into the bucket while chanting. He said that we needed to wash ourselves in the water prior to the next day's ceremony. We? I asked, as I thought I was only going to be involved in this first day's rites. Yes, you must come and witness. Watch their faces. So I took a Tupperware container with blessed water and went home. The next day, Carlos arrived with our business associate's wife and another Cuban girl. They both practice Yoruba, so they were there to help with the ceremony and also translate for Carlos. However, neither of them had a very firm grasp on the English language, so their translations were not always complete. This led to a little confusion about what was actually happening. From what I gathered, this day's ceremony involved cleaning my sister-in-law and brother-in-law's chi. Carlos believed that the horseman had attached himself to both of them and was draining their energy. He needed to first clear their chis before he could clear the house. We had been instructed to wear white, and we also had to cover our freshly washed heads in holy water with a white handkerchief. Carlos began the day's ceremony by writing some special symbols in chalk on the kitchen floor. He drew a large circle and then a small circle just outside of the large one. He placed a candle in the small one and asked my sister-in-law to step into the large one. He told her, relax, close your eyes, take some deep breaths, and then began walking around her and chanting in Yoruba. After a couple of circles, he took the candle out of the small circle and then put it in the large circle on the ground between her legs. He then began walking around doing more chanting. After a while, he grabbed one of the brand new white plates, and I must stress that he had not touched the plate prior to this, and he picked up the candle. He held the candle under the plate and again began walking around her while moving the candle in a circle underneath the plate. He did this for a while when suddenly he yelled and put down the candle and showed us the plate. What I saw on that plate made the hair on my arm stand straight up. The plate was now black, stained with the smoke from the candle, but it wasn't just a smoky mess. The stain looked like the face of a man with a beard. It was distinct and obvious to anyone looking at it. He took the plate, went outside, threw it into one of the stone patios, shattering it, thereby releasing the spirit that was attached to my sister-in-law's chi. He came back, took some broken coconut shells, and began asking the gods a series of questions. Through this process, Carlos discerned that the spirit he had caught on the plate was not the horseman, but the protector of the horseman. The Cubans explained that this occasionally happened when an exceptionally strong spirit would try and trick the priest into thinking it had gotten the big bad. Consequently, Carlos had performed the rite all over again. He walked around my sister-in-law with the plate and the candle, chanting again. This time, Carlos was louder and angrier. And when he showed us the plate, the smoke had made the shape of a horseshoe with a face inside. Again, Carlos threw it onto the patio and shattered the plate. He came back in and performed the coconut shell divination, and this time he was informed that he did indeed cleanse the horseman from my sister-in-law. Then it was my brother-in-law's turn. Carlos began the rite. At first, it was very similar to my sister-in-law's, but then Carlos stopped and backed up. He began to stand, frowning, with his arms across his chest. Then he began motioning like he was using a bow and arrow, and then he put his hands over his head, mimicking a headdress. Carlos explained that my brother-in-law had a guardian spirit that was a warrior, a Native American warrior. While our attention was directed towards Carlos, my brother-in-law was in my periphery, and for an instant, I swear his face changed. It became longer and more tanned. When I turned my head to look more directly at him, the face change was gone. Carlos continued on with the rite of the white plate and candle. And when he was done, Carlos showed us the plate. It was three faces of the horseman, one looking left, one looking right, one looking center. Both my sister-in-law and brother-in-law felt remarkably lighter after this rite, but also quite drained. So allowing them to rest, I offered to drive the Cubans back to their place. While in the car, Carlos asked me if I saw anything, and I said that I had seen my brother-in-law's face change. Carlos smiled and nodded knowingly and said, "I knew you would see something. That's why I said watch their faces. You saw the native guardian shining through." The Cubans told us that the last night's ritual would begin after dinner and that we should have some light snacks afterward. We took that to mean this would be a quick ceremony. The night began with Carlos preparing the chicken by tying up its wings and feet. Things at this point had already been crazy, and they only got crazier as the night went on. And I know you're asking, really? A live chicken? But we already had gone down this crazy rabbit hole, and honestly, after the things I'd already seen, I was worried not to complete the ritual. The Cubans began to clear the house, and they did this by moving through the house with Carlos, hitting the walls with the chicken, and with the women spitting rum out in the rooms, all while blessing the house in Yoruba chants. The cleansing began in the basement. The only room in the entire house that had to be cleared twice was my niece's room. When they were done clearing the house, they had to clear us. Everyone had come up to Carlos individually and stood there while Carlos hit us with the chicken and blessed us with a protective and cleansing Yoruba chant. After all of us were cleansed, Carlos opened up the front door, put the chicken on the front stoop, and sacrificed it. He then poured out the gunpowder, lit it on fire, making a clicking noise like calling a horse. This drew the horseman out of the house, and Carlos was able to trap the horseman's spirit in the empty wine bottle. He then gathered up everything and went on a walk to dispose of everything. When Carlos returned, he wanted to have a closing ceremony. He described it as a ritual where you could pray and close the rites that we had just performed. He also wanted to reunite my sister and brother-in-law spiritually, as one of the horseman's objectives was to split up their marriage. Carlos filled some wine glasses with tap water, grabbed the Bible, and lit candles. The water in the glasses was really bubbly and remained that way throughout the ceremony. When I mentioned this to Carlos, he said it was evidence of the good spirits that were hanging around for the ceremony. He then began by reading excerpts from his Bible in Spanish and blessed their marriage. He had told them to hold hands, then place their hands on the Bible, close their eyes, open the Bible, and place their hands on a passage. Since their Bibles were in English, my brother-in-law took the passage and began to type it into a translator website so Carlos could understand it in Spanish. When he left the room, Carlos had my sister-in-law stand up and close her eyes. He hovered his hands by the side of her head and began moving his hands in a circle while chanting in Yoruba. She began swaying in accordance with Carlos's hands, even though her eyes were shut and Carlos was not touching her. As Carlos moved his hands in larger and larger circles and moving faster and faster, she kept up at an unnatural degree. I felt something evil leave the room. Carlos grabbed her by the shoulders and shook her furiously. I yelled for my brother-in-law, who came running and tackled Carlos to the ground. I grabbed my sister-in-law, who looked like she had just been woken from a trance. Carlos was being held on the ground by the Cubans and was yelling in a language none of us recognized. They were yelling for the spirit to leave Carlos, as he was clearly possessed by something evil. Eventually, he calmed and the evil presence lifted. This was the first of three spirits that visited us that night. It had tried to possess my sister-in-law, but Carlos made the spirit enter him instead. Carlos got up off the ground and sat down in a chair and crossed his legs in a feminine manner. He then began talking in a radically different voice, one that was actually a female voice. She asked for a shot of rum, and we all looked to the Cubans, as Carlos does not drink. But they said, give her some rum. And Carlos's wife's guardian spirit, Carlotta, had taken over his body to protect Carlos from the evil spirit that was hurting him. We gave her some rum. She shot it back, and she shot back another and another. And then she began doing some interesting things. She had us each stand up, and she blessed us. When she got to my brother-in-law, she hit him in the stomach and then began a motion of pulling something out of his stomach. 7 years prior to this experience, he had battled cancer that was located right where Carlotta was pulling. Carlotta said that she would not have to worry, that he would not have to worry anymore about the cancer coming back. She then sat back down and finished the entire bottle of rum and asked for more. When we told her that there was no more rum, she said goodbye and Carlos dropped his head. He began laughing in a much deeper tone than Carlos would talk in. We looked to the Cubans again for clarification. They said that this was Carlos's guardian spirit, Carl. Carl asked for more liquor and a cigar. We gave him some vodka and found a cigar atop the fridge. He drank the vodka and complained about it. Apparently, he also liked rum. He then pointed at me and beckoned me over. He grabbed my hands in one of his and then began swirling his cigar above my hands. I began to pull my hands away as I was worried about being burnt. He grabbed my hands harder and told me, "Don't be afraid." And then he put the lit end of the cigar in his mouth and began blowing the smoke out of his mouth over my hands. He said to me, "Don't be afraid anymore, my child. Your hands have now been blessed by God." I looked at him dumbfounded, as there is a condition that runs in my family where the tendons in your hand begin to shorten and eventually your hands become deformed. And I've always been afraid of this happening to me. He let go of my hands, finished the vodka and the cigar. When he asked for more liquor, we told him there was none, and he left and said goodbye. When Carlos came back to us, he stood up stone cold sober, even though Carlotta and Carl had polished off two 26-ounce bottles of liquor. We told Carlos what had happened, but the zero recollection of anything happening to him except for the bad taste in his mouth from the cigar. And that's the end of the story. Their house was completely fine. My niece never had another nightmare ever again. My brother-in-law's cancer has never returned, and my hands are completely normal. Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
It's a wild ride.
I know. What a very fascinating ritual. Just like, you know, different cultures, different religions, exorcism rituals.
Mm-hmm.
That Yoruba thing, it's been so long now. I can't remember all the details, but I have studied that before.
Yes.
It was this, I want to say it's called the Matamoros cult or the Matamoros killings. Mm. And I did a live time suck about it, like early
on. That's where it sounds familiar from. Yes.
Yeah. And it was this Adolfo Costanzo maybe or something. But like the type of rituals, like the chicken and stuff, like they would do like these sacrifices and tributes. Sure. And there's these different deities that you can make your sacrifices to, like some more like, I guess you'd say demonic,
uh-huh.
Some more like angelic, I guess.
Okay.
And, but those guys, God, last time I heard about this religion, they went like to the dark side, the darkest side of this uh-huh. Yoruba. And they were doing human sacrifices. It was like a narco cult. It was this crazy thing where there were these cocaine dealers, like this.
You said narco.
Yeah, narco, okay. like kind of like a small cartel.
Uh-huh.
Dealing a lot of coke, and they thought that if they made these human sacrifices to some god in that religion, it would make them invulnerable,
they couldn't be caught.
Yeah, like what? Invincible. That's the word I was trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the point that like some of the guys in this cult, they had these standoffs with the police, and these guys just started walking towards the police, refusing to drop their weapons, kept shooting. And then the cops were just like, okay. And then just shot them dead.
Right. Of course.
Because they thought they were bulletproof.
Dang.
Like they really like got deep in this, but they were doing all these rituals and these sacrifices and these incantations and stuff. And yeah, it's really, really fascinating. The thing about the rum, the two bottles.
A bottle of rum and a bottle of vodka. That's insane.
Bottle of rum, bottle of vodka.
Same.
One person while possessed with different entities or spirits, drinks two bottles and then comes out sober. That would be so hard to write off as not having some paranormal element. I'm like, that, because that's not possible.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
I would love to be possessed by like something that gets to eat everything and I get to taste it, but then I feel zero effects of the calories.
Yeah, I want to be possessed by Mickey Mantle. And then I just have like a legendary tolerance of alcohol, just go out, eat steaks and stuff, still be super athletic.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Man, that was that was a very gripping. That was a really fascinating tale.
Yeah, yeah, it was really, really great, and it was quite long. And so there was a detail that I did cut out just to kind of keep engagement in it. But the person who sent in the story tells this other detail about that when she was driving the Cubans home, from the second day, she asks Carlos, you know, and names were changed here, so that's why I think Carlos, Carlotta, like all the names are very similar.
Yeah.
What do you see when you see me? And he began talking about like her knee, like some problem with her leg or something. Uh-huh. And he, you know, had never known her before. And so she had like tendonitis or something in her knee.
Yeah.
And kind of like left it at that. And then later when they have another conversation, he talks about like a spirit that he sees or is attached to her or a guardian angel. And this connected spirit owns a... something in France, like is a can-can dancer or something. Well, it turns out the woman who sent in this story was a dancer and stopped dancing because of this tendonitis, but has this like angel spirit that's like with her that, you know, like just all these like little, they were peripheral details outside of the main story, but just additional pieces of, there is no way this person who lives in Cuba, has never been to Canada before, has never met the sender of the story before,
right,
can hone in on illness and, you know, pain in the body and spirits connected. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man. And it did make me think of the movie that we saw last night. Because
The
A Night with the Devil.
Late Night with the Devil.
Late Night with the
Devil. That guy that goes by one name.
Oh,
that was like
that,
the medium.
Well, there's that guy. But also, as you were sharing your notes from this story, there was a group of, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a group of people living in a home practicing.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. They were practicing some type of like, not Yoruba,
like a dark
Santeria, voodoo.
Yeah. And you said a name of like some guy. And I was like, oh,
Adolfo.
Wait. Yeah. I think they like referenced him in that movie. There's like a weird, oddly enough, the movie we saw last night has a lot of connection. I saw a lot of connective tissue between that and this. I was like, weird.
Yeah.
But also,
I'm going to try and get his name just because people are listening. It'll take me 1 second.
Yeah.
It's Adolfo something. And also, The X-Ray Man would be a good name for a horror movie, possibly, like the beginning of that story.
I thought it could be like a not super scary, but like fun animated, like horror piece.
Yeah.
You know, like something a little spooky for kids who are not quite ready to go all the way.
And it is Adolfo de Jesus Costanzo. Back in the 80s, he had this narco cult. The godfather of Matamoros. They called him like the witch doctor and stuff too. But I don't think it wasn't a traditional cult. It didn't have like a name. But yeah, but he's the guy, Adolfo Costanzo.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy story.
Yeah. And then like the sacrifices, there was, you know, an element of sacrifices in the movie from last night.
So yeah.
Just kind of interesting timing.
Mm-hmm.
Kismet, you might
say. Yeah, that story came in.
You know, I chose this weeks ago without knowing that we were going to see that movie. And it's like, oh my gosh,
and
strange.
Right before the show, we'll have to talk about it somewhere. I love that Kelsey Cook, a comic and friend of ours, recently had a paranormal, which she felt was a paranormal experience.
Yeah.
In a hotel room where, like, you know, sudden chills and stuff.
It's fresh in our mind. Let's do the shout outs and then let's revisit that.
Just real quick.
Yeah, so you guys can have your shout outs. And then if you would like to hear something.
It's just really quick.
Yeah. Just a quick thing about something that happened to a friend of ours. You can stay. If not, you can go. Do you want to do Scooby Show?
Annabelle's.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank the following Annabelles for supporting our show. Appreciate it greatly. Nikki Howell, Julie Gibson, Alberon De Rico, Lean Mean Green Mini Peen, Jumaine, Amber Sours, Pull Out Fail.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Tyler Eckhart. We love Tyler. He's been a fan of both shows for a long time.
Long time. Was at camp last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a good one.
Yeah, he's a good one. Maddie Zorbrist and James Dox Tater. Doxtader.
Doxtater?
Doxtotter? Yeah, I've never seen a name quite like that.
Dr. Tater Totter?
Dr. Tater Tot. James Dr. Tater Tot. That sounds right.
That sounds correct.
Is your name Tater Tot? Dr. Tater Tot?
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I would like to thank the following Annabelles for their support on Patreon and allowing us to take your money and make great donations with it. We appreciate it so much. Darren Duty, Kesha Prouty, Kirby Rosenbloom, Emily Chambers, Donna, Sydney Adkins, Bo Hoffman, Jen Devrenny, Zachary Evans, and Maggie Simpson.
Maggie Simpson.
Okay, are your
baby Simpson?
I know. Like, are your parents huge fans? Is it just coincidence? Yeah. Is that your real name? Like, I have questions. And then I have a few spoopy shout outs.
Okay.
To Samara and Amethyst from your mom, Elizabeth. Happy birthday to one of you and happy belated birthday to the other. Love you both. To Amber from Amber, happy 31st birthday to me. To Jennifer from Jennifer, aka Jabberjaw, happy 50th birthday. To Ida from Cassandra, thank you for being my constant travel buddy and scary story companion. I'm sad to see you move away, but I know you'll make new friends and have great adventures wherever life takes you. You're an amazing person and friend. To Jer from Jer, happy 36th birthday, don't be a Darren. To Jennifer from Jennifer, happy birthday. You are in charge of your life and how this next year goes. You can do it, B.
Go B.
And then
before we wrap up,
so if you want to exit, peace out, have a great week, love you, see you next week. But if you want to hear a little something,
stick around. So you were talking to her. So Kelsey.
No, I didn't even talk to her. I just thought, okay, so our friend Kelsey. Okay, so we have these friends. They're both comics and they're a couple, Chad Daniels and Kelsey Cook.
Yeah.
And they have a podcast together.
Yeah.
Pretend Problems.
Yeah.
And it's lovely.
Very cute.
Very cute. And also, I'm like, oh, I'm just looking at my own relationship. So if you're looking for something light, great show. And so their clips show up in my feed because we're friends and I follow them. And Kelsey, I like catch it because it says like, I had my first paranormal experience. I'm like scarred for life. And I was like, oh my God, what happened? So I'm going into it thinking like nothing really happened. She's just being silly.
Yeah.
Turns out, so she was in Rosemont, which is a suburb of Chicago. And she was staying in a hotel near the airport. She does not disclose the name, but I'm sure with just a little Googling and this story, you can figure it out. She checks in. And at check-in, she's thinking like, is there a Korn concert like close by? Like, what is going on? Just based on the dress of the people in the lobby. So she's like a little, but whatever. Like, people travel for concerts. So she goes to her room, settles in for the night. And she's in bed, lights out. And the standard issue alarm clock from the hotel, you know, just like we've all seen it with the red sort of lights, it keeps getting like brighter and fading out and brighter and fading out. And it's like freaking her out because she's like, what the fuck is happening? That's so weird. And as she's watching this happen, she hears something fall in the room and she's like, oh, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And when she gets up to look, it's like her, I don't remember if it was just her key card for her room because that is so small and wouldn't make a sound. It must have been that in conjunction with something else. But regardless of where she had set the key card and this other item, I guess, it was not near the edge. Like, there was no reason it should be on the floor.
Yeah.
So she's like, what the fuck? And then as this is happening, her room gets ice cold. Like, freezing. And she is shivering. So now she sits up in bed and is on her phone and puts in the name of the hotel plus haunted.
Yeah.
And sure as shit, there are all these reports of this hotel being haunted. And specifically, that there was a young woman who died in the walk-in freezer of like the hotel restaurant. And of course, there's like foul play question, but that doesn't matter. It's like a young woman died in a freezer. So now Kelsey is a young woman. I mean, young adult, whatever. Uh-huh. She's in her 30s. She's a grown-up. She's a beautiful woman traveling alone in a hotel room. And now it's freezing cold. And she's like, what the fuck?
Uh-huh.
She's freaked out, gets up the next day, goes to check out. And in the lobby, if you go on Pretend Problems, you can see a picture of this. In the lobby is a sign for like a paranormal investigation meetup team. And it's like, there's like signs about like, go down this hallway, like meet over here. And so she says in her mind, it all makes sense that like, absolutely, not just an internet rumor, like this is a place people go to investigate.
Wow. Yeah.
And then she says something like, it all makes sense how everyone like looked like they were going to a Korn concert.
Yeah, it's
like
the paranormal look.
Yeah. I'm sure they've got like all this gear and she could not get out of there fast enough.
Yeah.
But she says she's ruined.
I love little stories like that. It just adds more credibility to me.
And I got to get on the phone with her
and
be like, okay, I need the rest of the details.
Yeah.
Like, what? I was sharing this before the show, and Logan pointed out, he's like, well, I wonder if, like, the light from the alarm clock, if it was just, he was, like, making jokes. He's like, I mean, yeah, people are just in the next room, like, tuning up their...
Yeah, charging their EVP recorder device. And,
they're
like,
just, like,
that's
pulling power.
Yeah.
But, like, all those people there trying to conjure something up, it would make sense that that... Like, maybe any other night there, not a big deal, but with all these people trying to get in touch with this haunted entity or various entities.
And I love that she had no idea what was going on, so it's not like she was heightened.
No.
It was just all that stuff going on around her.
And she's not hoping for it. She's not seeking it out. Like,
yep, wasn't on her mind.
That's not Kelsey's jam.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Also, Chad and Kelsey are on tour individually. Great
Very
comics.
Funny.
Great
funny.
People. If you were at summer camp last year, you saw them both completely murder. And,
You
know, even though you're not touring, we're still, like, you know, very much just a reminder to, like, get out there as you can afford it to support live music, live art, live comedy. Like, they're, you know, it's an important thing.
Yes, it is. And that is our show.
That is the show.
Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else at info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com.
That is correct.
I got thrown by the at and then at again. thanks to Logan Keith for editing, scoring today's show. Thanks to Heather Rylander, organizing the My Story emails. To book editor Drew Atana for polishing and preparing listener stories for book number 5. Thank you to Sophie Evans for finding the first story I told this week, and to Olivia Lee for finding the second. We are on YouTube if you would like to watch this show, and we're on Facebook and Instagram where we post pics that accompany episodes and more.
Make sure you go and look at it this week because the video.
Oh, yeah. Logan, will you be able to post that video to the Scared to Death feed?
In the carousel.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's do that. That'd be great.
I'll probably do the pictures in one post, and then I might do a second post for the video. We can talk about it. But yes, it'll be up.
Okay, cool.
It'll be up. So check it out. It is so weird.
We have a private Facebook group, Creeps and Peepers, full of horror lovers. Maybe they're talking about Late Night with the Devil in there. Big thanks to the All-Seeing Eyes, the Creeps and Peepers moderators, who continue to be fantastic. And enjoy your nightmares, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness and remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but have no home here within. Scare to death.
Mad Magic Productions.
Glenn, you mofo, doing your black magic.
Come on.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.